I have several things I want to combine and talk about tonight, and I don't know if I can do it skillfully enough that it seemed like one talk. Some of the, there's just a different, many different approaches to talking, Dharma talks. The monks in our tradition, especially the Thai monks, they write no notes. They don't really, I don't even know how much ahead they think of their talks. And they just talk. And it rambles around, and sometimes it's, you know, a progressive sequence, and sometimes it's an idea amplified. And Ajahn Sumedho, one of the most senior, who Mark mentioned, who was just sitting with him a few weeks ago, he calls his talks reflections. You know, doesn't even give them a subject, which is, it's relieving to somebody like me trying to make a talk together. And all this is by way of saying that I don't actually have a talk tonight. That's all these pieces of paper. So I'll share with you some of my reflections that I think of really the precious hearts of all of this to kind of like send you on your way with as you leave the retreat. I began to write a talk on a little... It's just a little couplet, a little piece of a chant, which I am going to do a little bit, a little later on. But as I did it and, you know, prepared myself and thought about it and everything, before I wanted to go there, I kept picking up this book, which I just was sent. It's one of the beautiful things about the Dana arrangement, that the way we live, where we talked about this afternoon, people give things. And so I was given a book called Love Poems from God. And Daniel Ledinsky is the translator, and there it's an accumulation of an anthology from all of the, a number of the most beloved love poets. And I just kept picking up these love poems and reading them, thinking I'd far rather talk about this than this other thing that I'm going to talk about later. And I realized actually this goes together with the theme of for me, the talk that I gave the last time, which is me, the whole theme of practice, which is how love leads to letting go. And so I'll just talk a bit more about some aspects of love before I move into the letting go, because it seemed like I wanted to get juiced up on love before I could go into the letting go part of the, as the next part of the talk, so there we go. I'm going to read a couple of these first. Called Love Does That. This is by, I should remember who this one is by, Meister Eckhart, one of history's great mystics, 1260 to 1328, German Catholic monk and scholar. All day long, a little burrow labors, sometimes with heavy loads on her back, and sometimes just with worries about things that bother only burrows. And worries, as we know, can be more exhausting than physical labor. Once in a while, a kind monk comes to her stable and brings a pear. But more than that, he looks into the burrow's eyes and touches her ears. And for a few seconds, the burrow is free and even seems to laugh, because love does that. Love frees. And then I couldn't but help myself read about Hafez, who I love his stuff so much. He was born in 1320 till 1389, the most beloved poet of the Persians, one of history's greatest lyrical geniuses. Though he is still little known in the Western world, many notables, including Emerson, Goethe, Garcia Lorca, the composer Brahms, and even Nietzsche were deeply affected by him. I didn't know that. This one's called Lousy at Math. Once a group of thieves stole a rare diamond larger than two goose eggs. Its value could easily have bought 3,000 horses and 3,000 acres of the most fertile land in Shiraz. Shiraz was the town in southern Persia where he grew up. The thieves got drunk that night to celebrate their great haul, But during the course of the evening, the effects of the liquor and their mistrust for each other grew to such an extent, they decided to divide the stone into pieces. Of course, then, the priceless became lost. Most everyone is lousy at math and does that to God, dissects the indivisible one. By thinking, by saying, this is my beloved, he looks like this and he acts like that. How could that moron over there really be God? Sound familiar? I encounter most morons on the road in front of me in a car. Momentarily. Then I remember. How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all of its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. This is with that moon language. Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, love me. Of course, you do not do this out loud, otherwise someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that is always saying, with that sweet moon language, what every other eye in this world is dying to hear? It's the greatest time to listen to love poetry when you've had a week of softening and calming and your heart opens and it's so beautiful. It's wasted on the uninstructed worldling, I think. The morons in the car. This is a lovely one too, I know this one. Just sit there, it's called. Just sit there right now. Don't do a thing, just rest. For your separation from God is the hardest work in this world. Let me bring you trays of food and something that you like to drink. You can use my soft words as a cushion for your head. So simple. That's a nice way to start. Feel the feeling. Those little ripply sweet feelings. And along with that, do you feel a sense of relaxing, trusting? If you were with somebody who had a full moon in each eye and just said you what you exactly wanted to hear, you'd be fine. We know it's possible. We know we don't live with this a lot of the time, but we know, we recognize it. We recognize this is true. This is our true nature. And we know it. We don't need to be, you know, taught this stuff. We can trust that. We have that refinement in our instincts. This is our true nature. And all of the spiritual practices, whatever they are, the spiritual various schools, are endlessly trying to help us access our true nature in some form. Fortunately, we only have this moment to behave well in. I love that line. And I like this line too. We are the ones we have been waiting for. We always look elsewhere, beyond, just out ahead, just when the next. We do this all the time. And in doing this, we overshoot. That's the nature of the dukkha. That's the nature of the second noble truth, which is the if-only disease. It's overshooting that already this feeling, that feeling of tenderness, is. It's already resident. It's just We forget it because we look elsewhere. What do these teachers say? I had a great quote here somewhere. We are so habituated to looking away from ourselves constantly. It is this very looking away that creates the emptiness we're trying to fill by looking away. I'll say that again. We're so habituated to looking away from ourselves, out there, change the condition. Constantly, we do it constantly. It is this very looking away that creates the emptiness we're trying to fill by looking away. It's how we do it that causes the disease that we're trying to fix, and we only know how to fix it by keeping on doing the thing that causes the disease. We're trapped in this. This is actually called samsara. It's a prison of our own mental creation. It's a prison of perception. And we don't know any other way to do it uninstructed. And not just that we don't know any other way to do it, we do it with such great conviction, because it's not just that we don't know another way, we really believe that that way is the way. We believe it so completely that we keep on and on chasing the dream somehow, chasing our tails. This is why, this is the only reason why we have to practice, because it's a simple shift, it's a very simple shift to not look away from ourselves. It's what's hard is that we are not trained to do the simple shift, we're trained to do the other with great intensity and great persistence over many years. And so it's just a changing of conditioning. That's the only reason it's hard. So when we say, you know, it doesn't matter what the conditions are, how are you with those conditions? That's the shift. Not looking away. Just getting to see, oh, I'm looking away again. So we need to forgive ourselves, you know, it's just a habit. It's not sin. It's not evil. You know, it's just a mistake. We make a mistake. Barking up the wrong trees. So there's actually two things I'm going to explore with you. One is another of my favorite Hafiz poems. And I just wanted to unpack it. And I was in Victoria a couple of weeks ago and did this very thing. So Brock, wherever you are, you've heard this already. But it's such a beautiful poem. So it's more of it's unpacking a love poem. And then I'm going to unpack the other one that I thought I'd do my whole talk on subsequent to this. Here's the poem. Hafiz. The small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful rowdy prisoners. The small man or woman, the small person, the conventional ego-based, self-centered us, the uninstructed worldling, builds cages for everyone he knows. Puts things in boxes, gives them labels, stops the river that's flowing, and catches a bit, says, this is good, I want more of this, this is not so good, don't want this. Takes out from the flow, from conditionality, the individual components, as I already talked about last time. We only do that for everyone we know, though. We don't do it for everything. We do it for the things that register in our minds. Because when you're sitting there, say, for instance, in meditation, there's an awful lot going on that you're not putting in cages. But the stuff that's occupying your mind, your story, your papancha, your stuff, that's the stuff you're putting in boxes, in cages. That's the stuff that you're taking out of the big flow and having some business with. U Tejaniya, teacher from Burma, would say, he calls that getting involved. His advice was like, don't get involved. Don't get involved. Somebody would explain something. They'd had some experience. One woman had a beautiful meditation experience and everything was all gold, and I don't remember, it was some lovely tingly realization-y kind of thing, and she described it to him. And he says, "Don't get involved. Carry on." Wasn't impressed at all. It's just another thing. It's another piece of the river, so easy for us to pick out. Even especially, you know, we think we've had some great insight. I just had this amazing realization. Even then, we get hung up. We certainly do with the difficulty. The small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage, love that word sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low. This is what happens. The Buddha calls it the heart grown wide with understanding. We become so much more expansive that we have to even duck for the moon. So the sage keeps on. That's the S of the slow. That's the virya of practice. Keep going. Not a mad dash, just a steady keeping on going. The sage keeps dropping keys. This is where it gets really interesting. So you're sitting here becoming a sage, becoming exalted, becoming refined, becoming divine, growing into your deep true self, expanding from your little tight anxious one, both of which are real, by the way, constantly, but some of them get to be at the forefront sometimes. But the balancing is to be little and vulnerable and needy and hopeful and sweet and scared, and the big one is knowing it. I see you, my little one, being vulnerable. That's okay. But as long as it's seen, we're not the small man. Dropping keys. This doesn't say going in there and opening up the dungeons and dragging them out. This isn't doing very much. It's just the possibility. There's freedom's possible. It's an invitation. It's a gift. It isn't an instruction. It isn't a doing even. It's making available freedom, which is very respectful. It's not like running the show or taking charge or imposing an agenda, which is a setup, of course, for frustration and for judgment and for failure. But it's making available freedom, dropping keys it's all night long. That's the keeps. All night long, and all day, and all life long, for the beautiful. Beautiful. Do you have any beautiful prisoners lurking in there? Of course you do. We tend to leave them underneath, though. This is our Judeo-Christian upbringing. We can't go around flaunting our beauty, because then, you know, immediately you're cut down. Who does she think she is? So we tend to, keep them down a little. We imprison them in our guilt or our trying to be cool or our wanting to be something. There's so much beauty inside all of us. I just was reading about it. Remember that one I read the other night about the angels grumble? Because they know that we're beautiful. We just forget, you know. We cover up. The prison is really a covering. It's the covering of judgment, the covering of fear. It's like a weight keeping the prisoners imprisoned. I really, really want you to invite your beauty, your beautiful prisoners out. Acknowledge them. That's what metta is all about. That's what self-metta is all about. Those of you who've listen to me for over time since I've been teaching, have heard me say this, but I still say it. One of the big shifts in my metta practice, which was either impossible for me because I couldn't do it, or I just, the opposite, I actually had adverse reactions to it. Oh, I'm hopeless, oh, I can't do this, this is way too something, I'm not good enough, I can't love, my heart's made of stone. It's a ridiculous thing to say, but that's sure putting my beauty in the prison, all right? Was one day, happened spontaneously on a retreat, walking in my walking period, and for some reason it just finally was allowed out, I guess, I'd been dropping enough keys, that out came my own best friend person, whom I didn't particularly think I ever had, you know. I had friends when I was a child, and then the best friend craze along. The best friend craze came along, and I didn't have one. My two friends became each other's best friend, and that left me out. You know, that awful feeling. Anyway, I'm doing my walking practice, and suddenly I'm being my own best friend, and I'm actually being really nice to myself. And not with any formal meta phrases or anything sounding recognizably Buddhist or anything, but I just was like, you're not doing so badly, you know. There's this little friendly voice. It's okay. Look at what you've done with your life. Hey, look where you are now, considering where you were. My God, that's pretty good. So there was this just little friendly, cheery, encouraging, went on for 45 minutes. Completely, it was fabulous. Just was a nice little, instead of the like, voice, you know. Come along. Oh, not again. Oh, God, Heaven. That one was a pretty well-established one, but this other little, like, it's fine. It just was showing me things that were fine. It was prisoners had been lurking for a long time were actually coming out and presenting themselves to me, and I couldn't but agree, you know. I actually was okay. I was actually a reasonably nice person. I had good friends. They liked me. I liked good things. I had decent taste. You know, I didn't like weirdos and, you know, people addicted to the wrong things, you know. I had a good taste for morality, for instance, you know. I had always good sila. I was a nice person. And it was lovely to actually be able to hang out with that person and say yeah to her. Dropping keys all night long for the beautiful, rowdy prisoners. How about the rowdy ones? Well, we all know the rowdy ones are there, but what do we do when we know there's a rowdy part of us? We lock it back in prison. Oh, we say, oh no. Or we project it onto somebody else and get really mad at them, like the driver in the car in front. We avoid them, we deny it, we act it out, we do all. We don't just welcome these prisoners out. Our tendency is to put them in cages. That's the prison. So our practice is dropping keys. That's all we do, is we practice. And what happens is keys get dropped, actually. Mysteriously, the prisons can open, and we can start seeing the beautiful things and the rowdy things. And when they come out into the light of our awareness, they're no longer imprisoned in the unconscious. And when they're not in the unconscious, imprisoned by our not wanting to deal with it, not wanting to either admit it or allow it, it's a subterranean motor driving all of our urges, all of our needs. When it comes out, we have some choice. What do I think about that? Oh, look, I see that I'm really irritated. And when we see that, and we keep seeing that, because we keep all night long doing it, we see irritation. We see irritation sucks. We see irritation as like, it doesn't make the slightest difference. All it does is wear me out. It doesn't solve anything. It doesn't make the thing I'm irritated with go away. It just goes on bothering me. We see how it all works, how we keep trapping. We're not actually trapping the things. We're trapping ourselves. We're trapped by this behavior.
Thank you.
Name of the poem? Dropping Keys by Hafez. Can they be both rowdy and beautiful? Yes. We think the rowdy are the bad. That's our linear thinking. If it's rowdy, then it's not okay, and I have to somehow learn to come to terms with it or get very wise so I'm spacious enough to be able to sit with my rage. There's something beautiful about us. Our rage is our attempt to be strong and be healthy when something's been oppressing us, for instance. Our grief is our loving that's now having to end. If there wasn't the loving, there wouldn't be the grief. It isn't just beautiful and just rowdy. And beauty can become rowdy. Rowdy can become beauty in a turn of a hair. So that's what you've been doing, dropping keys all retreat long for your beautiful rowdy prisoners and getting to know them more. Then you can do this with them, which is what Rumi says. A lot of you know this Rumi one. Have it somewhere. Rumi, where are you? We need big desks. Mm-hmm. You know, pretty soon what we're going to do is we're going to bring our laptops in here and just go, click, Rumi. Here he is. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. I'd call those prisoners. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. She may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door, laughing. Invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Welcome difficulty. Learn the alchemy true human beings know. The moment you accept what troubles you've been given, the door opens. It's all in that acceptance, which is what dropping keys is. It's accepting, allowing. So when we are able to do enough of this, we relax. We become confident that it's doable. The boulders turn to gravel. The miscellaneous problems, we forget and we're overwhelmed. And again we remember, oh, just this moment. We just have this moment to deal with. Okay, this moment feels like this. It becomes doable, workable, seeable, knowable, sensible. And it, whatever it is no longer, it's just yet another teacher, another guide from beyond. It isn't about the its, it isn't about the visitors. It's about being able to allow. It's about our awareness that can allow. It doesn't matter what. So Utejaniya, again, a teacher in Burma, would say, to anything anybody said, he'd either say, don't get involved, or else he would say, so what? So what? That's a fabulous question. So what? So what? The real question is, so what am I making that into? So what? Not so, it's not dismissive, so what? It's not like, oh, doesn't mean, it's not as disrespectful as that, but it means so. It's a fabulous question. So you're going along, no. Ask yourself, so? Oh, that's what I'm doing with that. That's what I'm turning. That's my acupuncture. That's look at what's going on here. It's really helpful. So what? So as we keep doing this practice, keep discovering that we can so what the various visitors, we can allow these prisoners out, we get more confident, we apply ourselves more, we are less anxious because our confidence in our ability to be with life grows. And then it goes from being little me and all of these big things, oh, to being bigger me. And these things are just like, oh, here's this one, oh, here's this one. And as time goes by, it's like the waves just don't seem to be so dramatic. It's like we have an increased capacity to float along the river. And so it's okay. Nothing's really changed but our capacity to be able to be with it, to allow it. That's all that's changed. Ups and downs are always going to happen. Confidence grows. When we're more confident, we're more relaxed. When we're more relaxed, we're more happy. We have more space. We're not so hanging on to ourselves. Therefore, we're more kind because we can relate more to people. There's more room for them. So we become nicer company. People like us more. We become more confident. It just grows. So now I'll move into the other part of my talk that I was going to start with. And how I'm going to do this is, Linda, you're going to help me for a moment. You're going to open the doors that are above your head. I'm going to listen for 5 minutes. I've got to get up. Linda, volume up. Big right knob.
Rest in natural. Rest in natural. Rest in natural. This is the kind of rest, the comfort and ease, to just let go, just with this natural movement. Then it is not your ordinary self, just like the glass of money water. If you don't stir it,
And you know, we can't actually rest unless we feel safe, unless we feel comfortable, unless we have a certain amount of acceptance and friendliness. But then we can. To take rest. To naturally be. Rest in natural great peace. When you rest in something, you are smaller than the thing you're in. Natural great peace is this big goodness that's way bigger than you, small you. It can hold us. We can trust it. It's huge, ongoing. Think of the tradition, for instance. Think of however many teachers there have been over time of human beings, all giving the same messages in their own ways. It's big. You can rest in it, you can trust it, can hold you. It is the truth that liberates, not our efforts to be free, says Krishnamurti. The truth is already there. We're just discovering that it's already there in us. As we get out of the way more and more. The Dhamma is another word for the truth. Natural. Not a contrived thing, not a thing to get, to find, to manufacture in some way. We don't create the rose, you know. All we do is we take care of we cultivate the ground and we give it attention and we see it's got aphids on it. We do what we can with the aphids. We give it water, we nourish it. But it does what it does. It's just a natural unfolding. Bigger than us, we can rest. We don't have to be running the whole thing. There's a line or two of a Tibetan poem. It's like, space is there, open, inviting, and comfortable. Space is already there, open, inviting, and comfortable. When the mind relaxes, when the heart softens, It's experienceable. This is what makes this practice so fantastic, is that in a moment you all know we experience that feeling. There's space. It's open. It's inviting. It's comfortable. We can rest in it. We didn't do it. We didn't make it. We just could see how we were in our own way by trying, by looking out. Great, as opposed to the small man building cages. It's the sage. This expansive feeling. Peace. This is the highest happiness, according to the Buddha, peace. Not fun and giggly and juicy and dramatic and Hollywood-ish. It's quiet. the most nourishing, deepest happiness, the sure heart's release, as the Buddha called it. Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind. Not my exhausted mind or your exhausted mind, but this tendency we all have. It's a human, it's a universal, it's just a conditioned behavior, a conditioned perception, a conditioned belief that by looking for outside ourselves we'll find this diamond we're looking for. This mind that we all have, that we all know, that we're all exhausted. It's so a shareable thing. We're all in this journey together and we're all crashing around going the wrong way. Mice and the little wheel that you give a mice to exercise it. You put the thing in a tiny cage, but so that it doesn't, you know, so that it doesn't lose every muscle, you then give it a wheel so it can pretend it's going somewhere. And it's kind of like us, like endlessly trying to go somewhere and never getting anywhere. It's exhausting. And this trying is so exhausting. Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind. Another of the words for dukkha is stress or panic. Chogyam Trungpa would say basic panic. It's like that jumpy, wiry, gotta get it together, gotta find something, solution, get rid of it, busy. In the moments when the heart relaxes and the mind lets go, it's such a relief. When you have an insight into the truth of something, the flavor is relief. I say this to everybody all the time. When somebody goes like, oh, I say, feel the relief. Like that's the every moment of realization, tiny or enormous, is exactly that flavor. Resting from this exhausted, frantic trying to find it. And mind, this exhausted mind, in the Pali language the word is citta, and it means heart/mind. It isn't just the mind, it's not the thinking, knowing, analytical, conceptual, it's just the sense of your conscious one. Beaten helplessly. Because as much as we try, something else comes up. It's like we just are not in charge. We try and get it all organized, and then some other thing happens way, way bigger than us. The body, things happen. Other people do things. Circumstances, unbelievable circumstances. That's the way we feel so like beaten up by it all. We just can't defend because it's way too big. Out of control, overwhelmed. We're bruised. In spite of every great effort, we're just bruised by it, beaten helplessly. By karma. Karma. Beaten helplessly by the fact that life is this river. And because this happens, it makes this happen, which makes this happen, and then this happens, and this happens, and somewhere in there's us. And all these happenings come and affect us. It's not just this one thing that we could get a handle on and sidestep. It's because it's a whole flood of things. There isn't one thing. There is no such thing as a separate anything. There is anatta. Nothing is separate from anything else, ultimately. So there's this flood of happenings. No wonder we're beaten helplessly by it. It's unmanageable. It's uncontrollable. It's the flood. Karma. Conditions creating conditions. So karma can be seen both in the receiving of the previous conditions which are unfolding, which are way beyond anything we could have known or done much about, maybe a little bit. And that's the past up into this moment. And then it goes on and on from this moment where I'm involved. It's this river that goes on, and I'm a participant. I'm a recipient, except that there's so many factors that it's beyond my control. Of course I'm like this, because all these things have happened. And then I'm a participant. It's happening to me and in me and with me, and I'm also happening. And the Buddha suggested that we think in terms of that one rather than the first one. If you think in terms of karma happening to you, it's so easy to become the victim or to blame or to regret and all that. But if we think in terms of the karma, the part of that's coming, that we're creating, that we're contributing to, creating is too, makes us too important. We're just contributing to. We're making an influence. What's that influence? Is it helpful? Are you contributing a little more pain or a little less pain? That's our only responsibility, and it's our whole responsibility, and it's all we can do, and it's hugely influential, and it's tiny in the flood. But if we didn't do it, another one of Hasu's poems, but I haven't got it with me, is like something about, how could I tell you something, Mother, if you haven't been taking your medicine every day? You have to do your thing, and you take your medicine, and you do your seeing clearly, and see how much you're contributing and what, and then the force is with you. Karma. Neurotic thoughts. Neurotic. We always think of neurotic as nuts, you know, insane kind of thing. But neurotic is I think of neurotic as inappropriate, extra, just too much or slightly off. And one of the descriptions which I love the most about an enlightened moment, when there's wisdom and balance and steadiness and an open heart, there is an appropriate response to something, to anything. Life is happening, and to one of those little moments, those experiences, the response is appropriate. If it needs care, it gets care. If it needs space, it gets space. If it needs water, it gets water. If it needs a hand on the brow, it gets a hand on the brow. If it needs an ambulance to take it to hospital to check out its blood pressure, it gets an ambulance to take it to hospital, as happened to Pat this evening. It's like an appropriate response. There's no argument, there's no wondering. It's just the available, kind, open being in that moment of being available and open and kind is appropriate. Neurotic isn't appropriate. It's like, oh, well, maybe, and what if, and how about, and it's all complicated and like a child having a paddy, as they say in Ireland, isn't appropriate. It's not bad, it's just not helpful. Neurotic thoughts, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite ocean of samsara. Oh. It's relentless because it just, we're trying. How many times have I heard you say that to me? Oh, I know, but I just keep forgetting. It's just relentless because it's so conditioned. The way the mind is, the way it looks beyond itself, it's so conditioned. That's what it means by relentless. It just goes on and on and on. That's why we have to practice. If it was just, we could just get it, there wouldn't be any practicing required. We would all just think ourselves free. It'd be fabulous. But that's not the human reality. It needs a, because of its relentlessness, that's why practice is part of our lives. The relentless fury of the pounding waves and the infinite ocean of samsara. So samsara is that treadmill. You know, it's just like, and in this moment something's understood and then it's forgotten again in the next. But those, that circling, that chasing the tail, that being lost and that being lost, it gets less. It gets shorter. It's known sooner. It's laughed at more easily. Welcome and invite them all laughing. It's okay that we're just these mere people. We're just people with these minds who want to be happy. We just don't quite remember all the time the right ways to be happy. It gets lighter, it gets more fun. So this heavy, you know, sentence, ugh. Part of this, remember, is from the era of the Buddha, and absolutely in Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhism, is the complete conviction of reincarnation, and that you have, we've all been born thousands and thousands and thousands of times because we still haven't yet learned it. It's got that relentless feeling, oppressive feeling. You may or you may not believe that. That's a belief. I would suggest, at least what is what I do, if it helps me, if it motivates me to care, then it's a useful reflection. If it just depresses me and numbs me out and makes me head for the fridge, it's not very useful. It's not that, you know, I don't have to beat myself up that much with like, oh, the relentless fury of the pounding. But at times, it's actually just like, yep, you know, life happens, and then things change, and then it's that bigger perspective. So not, it's not to be depressing, it's to be a motivation. It's like, and if you do think of this, and you do care, that you can, in fact, change things, even if it's gradual, even if it just seems a little thing, in a moment, oh, that just feels so much better. It gives you the perspective to keep on keeping on, which is what we have to keep doing. If it's helpful fuel, then use it as fuel, eat it. But if it's actually just like a turn-off, then I wouldn't go that route, I'd take another one. The Buddha recommended that we say every day, we're going to get sick, nothing can stop it, we're going to get old, it's absolutely inevitable, we will die, it's absolutely part of the deal, you can't be born and not have that happen. You're going to lose everything you love and you're attached to somehow or other. Either it'll break or someone will steal it or they'll leave or you'll die or something. It's inevitable. It's inevitable. And you will have your, whatever you're doing, however you're living your life, the quality of your consciousness will have repercussions. You cannot get away from it. He said, say that every day. Not in order to feel, oh, the relentless fury of the samsara. It's just like, do I want to keep doing it that way? Do I want to just keep going round and round like that little mouse? There is another way. I don't want to keep doing it. So it's like the proximate cause of compassion is pain. The proximate cause of liberation is dukkha. If there wasn't any dukkha, then we wouldn't want to, we'd be living in the sleepy Southern Gulf Islands forever and we'd never wake up. But fortunately, we get headaches. We have other things happen to keep reminding us that it isn't just la 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 la. It's actually difficult. And that makes us want to wake up. And it's not like then frantically have to get out of this. It's like relax already. Rest. We're greater. We don't need to be oppressed by this being human, this mind. It's optional. What we are seeking is what is seeking. What we are seeking is what is seeking? We're seeking our awareness outside of ourselves. Mary Oliver, I'll end with her. Seeing as how Mark was... I taught a retreat fairly recently and one person said in an interview, if I have to hear another Mary Oliver poem, I'm going to leave the retreat. So fortunately for you, this is the last chance. I won't read one tomorrow. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what's it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy and as singular, and each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence, and each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular or real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. But to have been a bride married to amazement. So, back to square one. Number one instruction. Wonder. My flow is beginning to begin with wonder now. Owl, wonder, flow, choose your order. Wonder. What's this? So that we can make that our conditioned response. What's this? What's happening? What's this like? And just trust that that's, we have that capacity. That's our true nature. What's happening? Let's just sit quietly.